so hard, the employees wanna find me. And then wanna hire me. What's 100K to a guy like me? Could you please remind me? Falling so hard, this ain't easy. Working late nights, you best believe me. My grades can only go ace. Never wanna see another B unless I'm Jay-Z. Falling so hard, let's get paid.
This is Morgan Greer.
This is Michaela Hayes, and you're listening to another episode of the Farm So Hard Ambulatory Care Podcast. All right, fam. Welcome to another episode of the Farm So Hard Ambulatory Care Podcast. Today, we are very excited to dive into the world of GLP-1 receptor agonists. It's a hot topic right now. So a fascinating class of medications transforming the management of diabetes and obesity.
Yep, it's definitely a hot topic in my job. And if anybody who works with me knows, I probably get on the soapbox about GLP-1s 20 different times a day. So if any of my colleagues are watching, you'll definitely resonate and have probably heard me say this a million other times. So, all right. So what we're going to start with is kind of the history, like where the heck did GLP-1s come from, especially considering they're so popular today. So Michaela, kind of walk us through what's the backstory with GLP-1s and how did we get here?
Yeah, that's a great introduction, Morgan. So just to start off with, what is a GLP-1 agonist? So it's a class of medications that mainly help to manage blood sugar or blood glucose levels in patients with either type 2 diabetes, and some GLP-1 agonists can also help treat obesity. The first GLP-1 receptor agonist that came to the market was exenatide, and it was approved by the FDA in April of 2005. For the treatment of type 2 diabetes. So since then, we've had a lot of GLP-1s come to the market, and some of those, well, the main reason why is they've shown clinical superiority to other anti-hyperglycemic drugs because they improve glycemic control and A1C. They reduce weight loss and blood pressure. They have cardioprotective benefits and effects, and all without having an additional risk of hypoglycemia, which is wonderful. There's currently 7 GLP-1 receptor agonists that are available on the U.S. market, all of which are subcutaneous injections, except for the semaglutide tablets or Rybelsus. And then Rybelsus came to the market in 2019 when it was FDA approved. So there's also a similar class that kind of falls into the category, and this is our GLP-1/GIP receptor agonist. There's currently one of these medications on the market, and I'm sure our audience would be very familiar with Mounjaro or tirzepatide, which is a once weekly subcutaneous injection. And also most recently, we've had Zepbound be approved for the weight loss management component. So just to get us an overall, you know, orientation to our GLP-1 class. So there are the 7 on the market. So we have dulaglutide, which is Trulicity. It's a once weekly sub-Q injection. We have exenatide or Byetta, which is twice daily sub-Q. We have the extended release version, which is Bydureon, which is once a week sub-Q injection. We have liraglutide brand Victoza, which is once a day sub-Q injection. Lixinitide, I always had a hard time with that one saying it in school, but it's a once a day sub-Q injection. Then we have Ozempic, which is our semaglutide sub-Q injection that's once a week. And then Rybelsus, like I mentioned, which is a semaglutide tablet, which is a once a day tablet with a lot of education components tied with that. So that's just a basic introduction into GLP-1. All right, moving on to the science behind these drugs. Morgan, can you explain the role of GLP-1s in the body?
Yeah. So, you know, I think GLP-1s are really interesting in kind of why they've become so popular, not just in diabetes, but also in the obesity side of things, is because they're multi-mechanistic. And so we'll kind of go into a little bit of that. So the GLP-1 stands for glucagon-like peptide 1, which essentially is a natural hormone that's in your small intestine, is usually released upon the ingestion of food. And it helps kind of in a bunch of different ways that I just led to. It's multi-mechanistic. So the first most important way that I kind of want to cover is how we're able to use these agents for both diabetes and then also for weight loss or obesity treatment. So it's that it increases that natural insulin secretion. But the important part about it is that it's glucose dependent. And so that's what really is able to make us be able to use it for both things. So really that insulin secretion again comes from your pancreas. And all that is in response to glucose. So again, it's glucose dependent. So with that, it means that if there is that extra glucose roaming around, then it's going to secrete more of that insulin. Now, if you don't have that extra glucose, aka somebody who doesn't have diabetes and is exclusively using this for the treatment of obesity or weight loss, it's not going to secrete more of that insulin. So that's how we're able to, you know, give this medication to people who, if you have diabetes, it's going to lower that blood glucose. It's going to lower your A1C. But then, you know, when we were originally investigating these things for weight loss, we were like, how is this not going to lower somebody's blood sugar if they don't have diabetes and then give them hypoglycemia? Well, this is exactly how. It's glucose dependent. So we're not really going to be worried, because if you don't have that extra glucose just like hanging around, that extra insulin secretion isn't going to happen mechanistically. So that's essentially what makes it safe for people who don't have diabetes. The other ways that it works is it blocks the glucagon secretion. So where that glucagon is made in your body, that raises your natural sugar levels, it also kind of blocks that secretion as well. But the major thing that we see on the obesity side that really helps in the treatment of obesity is it slows gastric emptying. So it's slowing how quickly your stomach is getting rid of its contents, which can make you feel fuller for longer. And it's also affecting more of maybe some of the mental battles that happen in obesity in regards to nutrition and eating. So in the effects of your brain, in those areas where you're maybe dealing with hunger or satiety levels, this is something you hear a lot from people when they talk about being on a GLP-1 specifically for obesity. You hear a lot of people talk about the food noise. The food noise just like suddenly goes away. And I think that's a really big thing that we talk about in the treatment of obesity with these agents, is it's not just necessarily the weight loss. It's not necessarily the physical, like clinical stuff that's happening but for a lot of these people, it's the mental. And that mental health is improving with the ability to decrease this food noise and their ability to, you know, not overeat and changing those habits over time.
Yeah, I love that you touched on just the food noise and the mental capacity that the drug plays on helping to control your satiety and your hunger levels. That's like something that I really hear from patients who use it for weight loss, is it really just makes them not hungry and they're not eating as much. And there's been all this data in the news about like it helping with GLP-1s in general, helping with depression and things about bone density from this weight loss. Some are good, some are bad. I'm excited to jump into that more in other episodes, but right now, like getting a good grasp on an introduction to the drug class. So that was really helpful.
All right, Michaela. So we've talked about GLP-1s having a lot of different uses, primarily with type 2 diabetes and also in the treatment of obesity. So, you know, can you tell us a little bit more about this and the different indications for these agents?
Yeah, that's great. So all GLP-1 receptor agonists are FDA approved to help improve glycemic control in patients with type 2 diabetes, as long as it's an adjunct to diet and exercise, of course. Wegovy, which the generic name is semaglutide, and it's marketed for the type 2 diabetes patients as Ozempic for its FDA approval in type 2 diabetes. And then we have Saxenda, which is liraglutide for its generic version, marketed as Victoza for its FDA approval in patients with type 2 diabetes. And while we're on the subject, like I mentioned earlier, Zepbound is tirzepatide for its generic brand, and that is the dual GLP-1 and GIP receptor agonist, and it's marketed as Mounjaro for its FDA approval in patients with type 2 diabetes. So semaglutide and liraglutide are FDA approved to reduce the risk of major cardiovascular adverse events in patients with type 2 diabetes and established cardiovascular disease. So that was a big win for GLP-1s. And then dulaglutide is FDA approved for improving A1C in patients with an increased risk of cardiovascular events. Lixinitide can be used in combination with long-acting insulins. And then high-dose liraglutide has been FDA approved for chronic weight management in patients age 12 or older with a BMI of 30 or greater. So now it's crucial to understand where these drugs fit in clinical practice and what the guidelines say about their position in therapy. So I'd love to hear more about that from your perspective, Morgan.
Yeah. I think the first thing is really breaking it down into indication, right? Because we have a couple different indications that we're looking at for these agents. And so kind of first starting with diabetes. So ADA, of course, guidelines are the bread and butter of what we really look to for people with diabetes, you know, what are we going to use? So when we look at the ADA guidelines, the new 2024 ones came out, I believe in November, actually, of 2023, but metformin is still kind of that first line therapy for all our patients with diabetes now, unless they're contraindicated, of course, for whatever reason from metformin. They're always going to try metformin first. And then if they're having persistent hyperglycemia or they're intolerable to metformin, you're really going to go down to that next like kind of phase two level of therapy. And so that's where it kind of branches out in the ADA guidelines. And so you can either go in two different directions. So one being our SGLT2s and then also our GLP-1s that we're talking about today. And so a lot of the rationale behind which one you're going to choose is going to be patient dependent, a lot of times revolving around their other comorbidities. And so thinking of our SGLT2s, do they have heart failure or do they have CKD? Because SGLT2s are indicated and have a lot of great data in slowing down the progression of chronic kidney disease. And then also for heart failure, specifically within heart failure, our SGLT2s are one of the only classes that actually have clinical statistical evidence in HFpEF, not only just HFrEF. So those are really significant medications we can use in those classes. So if you have a patient with diabetes that also has CKD or any type of heart failure, that might be something that you lean more towards to than a GLP-1. But for our GLP-1s, if your patient is more concerned or more motivated by weight loss, maybe needs a little bit more A1C lowering than what an SGLT2 can offer, maybe weight loss would also offer them more mobility, more opportunities for potential surgeries because of that weight loss in the future, the GLP-1 might be more of the favorable option for those patients. And so then when you go into the GLP-1s too, which GLP-1 do you choose? Unfortunately, that's really going to be insurance dependent, we're finding a lot of times in clinical practice. And so, you know, I think when we look and evaluate clinical studies, Mounjaro is the real powerhouse when we look at GLP-1. So specifically looking at Ozempic, which is our other most like popular one, when you look at the studies for those two main things that we're looking at with these agents, which is the A1C and the weight loss benefit. Specifically with A1C, your Ozempic is going to give you anywhere from like 1.2 to 2.1% lowering of that A1C, where Mounjaro is going to give you about 2.1 to 2.4% lowering of A1C. So it packs a little bit more punch in regards to lowering those glucose levels. The same thing kind of happens with weight. So Ozempic lowers on average maybe about 13 pounds for the typical patient, where Mounjaro lowers about 25 pounds for the average patient. So really in both of those scenarios, which are the major things we're looking at for patients, that's going to be a little bit more impactful with Mounjaro. The issue becomes insurance covered. And so what I'm finding in my clinical practice is that a lot of insurance companies are wanting you to fail two other GLP-1s before you can ever get approved for Ozempic or Mounjaro. So they're wanting you to fail like a Victoza and a Trulicity before they would ever pay for an Ozempic or a Mounjaro. So that's kind of frustrating, almost wanting patients to go backwards in efficacy before getting to the more efficacious agents. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Now, on the flip side for obesity, of course, we want to do our non-pharmacologic interventions first. So lifestyle modifications, calorie deficit, and exercise. But sometimes that's not always going to be as effective for certain patient populations. A lot of times that's limited by mobility. I have that for a lot of my patients. They have arthritis or other conditions that limit their mobility in their efforts to be able to do exercise or other regimens that might be more helpful in the treatment of obesity. So really, GLP-1s are coming in kind of after non-pharm as one of those first line agents for obesity for patients to try. Of course, if they don't have any other kind of contraindications to those agents.
All right. So dosing is always a key consideration as pharmacists and medication experts. How do we initiate and titrate GLP-1s, Morgan?
Yep. So that's going to be pretty different among all of the GLP-1s. And so even within the same generic product, let's take semaglutide, for example, depending upon your indication, there can be some major dosing differences as you especially get up to the higher doses. And so we could kind of start with, again, maybe some of the earlier medications, not really seen as much anymore. So Victoza, liraglutide, and then its counterpart Saxenda for the weight loss indication. And so Victoza Tozer, Saxenda, both of them, whether the indication of you're using, you're both going to start at 0.6 milligrams. The interesting thing about Victoza or Saxenda, because it is a daily injection, you can actually titrate it a little bit sooner. So typically with our other GLP-1s, you're going to wait about 4 doses or 4 weeks before you would jump up to the next dose. But with Victoza and Saxenda, since they're a daily injection, you actually about after a week can start jumping up to the next dose. And a lot of that is just judged on patient tolerability is kind of the biggest thing, because we'll talk about side effects a little bit later, but some of those GI side effects can be problematic for a lot of patients. And so they can only tolerate up to a certain dose. And so we're obviously not going to push patients if they're not experiencing, you know, favorable effects with that medication. And so for Saxenda, Victoza, you'll start at 0.6. Now, Victoza, if we're using it just for diabetes, is going to go up to the 1.8 milligrams daily. Now, again, and you'll see this kind of be the common theme amongst all the GLP-1s, if you're using it for weight loss, the dose can actually go a little bit higher. So with the Saxenda for weight loss, you go from 0.6 to the 1.2, 1.8, 2.4, and a 3. So 3 is actually going to be the max dose for the weight loss indication. If we move over to Trulicity, it doesn't have a weight loss counterpart, if you will. Trulicity is just Trulicity. So you start at 0.75, and then there's a 1.5, a 3, and a 4.5. So 4.5 is going to be that max dose. Moving into the semaglutide or semaglutide, however you would like to pronounce that, it's a little bit different. So remember with this kind of chain of GLP-1s, we have the oral formulation, so the Rybelsus. And so that starts at like a 3 milligram dose. And with the oral formulation, again, it's a little bit different than the weekly injectables. So you'll actually usually stay on one of those doses for about 30 days before you would start thinking about moving over to the next dose, which is kind of similar if you think about 4 weeks, 30 days with the other injectables that are a weekly injectable. It's kind of similar in that sense. So you started at 3, then there's also 7 and 14 milligram options for the oral Rybelsus. And again, a lot of that is glycemic control and then also tolerability for our patients. Ozempic Wegovy is another one where it kind of splits off depending upon your indication. So if we're doing Ozempic for diabetes, you'll start at 0.25 and then 0.5. And this is where it gets a little tricky because you have to also think about pen size and how the pens actually physically come. And so with Trulicity and then our Mounjaro, they are both made by Eli Lilly. So they have the one-time use pens. That's what they come in. But then if you look at Victoza and you look at Wegovy Ozempic, those are made by Novo Nordisk, so they're multi-use pens. And so thinking about when prescribing or starting people on these medications, specifically Ozempic and Wegovy, the 0.25 milligram and the 0.5 milligram are in one pen. They're in the same pen. So even if you have a patient start on 0.5 milligrams and go up to 0.5 milligrams, they could still use the same pen, but just go up to the next dose. However, if you go up onto the 1 milligram dose, they have to get a whole new separate pen. So you can't just get them to go up on the dose with the same pen. So it goes to a 1 milligram and then a 2 milligram. Now, if you're using it for weight loss for Wegovy, then you have a 1 milligram, a 1.7, and a 2.4 milligram. This is all a lot of different doses and can get kind of confusing. So that's why it's important to kind of familiarize yourself with the different indications and how the dosing can change per those indications. And so lastly, I'll just go over our Mounjaro and then its counterpart Zepbound, which is tirzepatide. And so what's nice about this with Zepbound, when it came out, I was super excited a couple months ago when it came out, is that whether you're using Mounjaro or you're using Zepbound, the dosing is exactly the same. It's you start at 2.5 and then the max dose is 15. Now, the only caveat I will say with Mounjaro is when they looked at it in the clinical trials, they designated that you needed to be on at least a 5 milligram dose for it to actually be efficacious. So if a patient started on a 2.5 and just couldn't tolerate the 2.5 dose, they unfortunately wouldn't be able to continue on Mounjaro because it wasn't going to be efficacious for them long term. They had to at least be on a 5 milligram dose. So that's a lot of information kind of throwing at you. And I encourage anybody, if you're looking at GLP-1s, you work with GLP-1s, to really look at the indication that you're going for and which product you're actually using. And taking a closer look, this is a little bit different than other things we use in clinical practice, where you really have to pay attention to like the strength and the package size and the actual physicalities of the pen, because they do change a lot between the products that you're using.
Yeah, that's really good. I wish they would just make it easy. Why do they have to always make it difficult and change the dosing and change the pens and all the things? But at least Mounjaro is keeping it kind of simple this time.
Hopefully. It's the newest one to be released, so maybe we're learning as we're going along how to make it a little bit easier. And again, Mounjaro is that one where it's a single-use pen. So you use it, the retractable needle comes back out, and that's it, and you throw away. You don't have to, you know, think about it with maybe some of the other ones that you still have to. All right, Michaela. So probably one of the important conversations or topics we'll have, especially from the patient perspective, this is what they're most concerned about, is side effects. So, you know, every drug has side effects. There's not going to be any drug that doesn't have potential side effects. So what are the really common ones for our GLP-1s? And, you know, how can that really impact patient adherence potentially? And then if patients do have side effects, how do we recommend or kind of mitigate around those side effects?
Yeah, I think patient education regarding medication side effects is such an important piece to helping with adherence, and something that as pharmacists, I feel like is our strong suit. We educate to help let them know what they're going to experience, because if you let the patient know upfront that they might experience some things and what to do to help mitigate that or how to handle it if they do experience side effects, they're much more likely to be adherent rather than coming across something they were not expecting, and then they don't trust you, right? If it's something that's super terrible and they really cannot stand experiencing this. Just for an example, my mom went to the doctor not too long ago, got a drug. It was like a nasal spray. And the doctor told her there's no side effects associated with this, because she started having like heart palpitations and having some massive reflux. And I was like, oh, what did the doctor say were some of the side effects when you started? And she was like, they said none. And I was like, well, that's not true. But we looked into it, and exactly what she was experiencing was the most common side effects. And the dose was managed based on patient tolerability. And we just adjusted it, and she talked with her doctor, and it was all good. And it was really helping her need it. So this is such an important topic for just patient care and adherence in general. But going back to GLP-1s off on my soapbox, the most common side effect that you really see with GLP-1 receptor agonists is nausea. And that's experienced, and when I educate patients on this, only about 20% of patients experience nausea. So, you know, just because you're on it doesn't mean you're definitely going to have nausea with it. Other things are vomiting and diarrhea. So we want to be careful with, like, if it's getting out of hand with dehydration, making sure that the patient understands that if they do experience these things, let us know. And it usually is worse when starting the drug for the first time and then escalating the dose. And if you just keep consistently going forward with the drug, it usually goes away with time and consistent use and proper and appropriate use. But if it is something that's a problem, we could try a different agent. Sometimes that's better, or just be slow with how we titrate the drug. You know, they have a recommended way to start and titrate, and that's not always the best, you know, scenario for every single patient. So just going on the patient-specific scenario. With just the way it works, patients can also experience a loss in appetite because, again, it's affecting the components of your brain to make you understand when you're full or those signals to your body about hunger and satiety. So that's something that patients can also experience, which is kind of how it works. So you will probably have a loss in appetite. I think something to monitor, especially with those using GLP-1s for weight loss, is that loss in appetite component. And this is just from talking to different people who are using the drug for weight loss. They just say they're not hungry. They're not eating. They're eating very few portions. And I think it can lead to some things. I mean, we'd have to dive deeper into the literature, but just thinking about that, you know, we want to make sure our patients are receiving proper nutrients and all the things that they need, and they're not just eating small portions of really terrible food options, right? This all goes hand in hand with proper diet and lifestyle modifications, and we want to make sure giving patients all areas of things like in their toolbox to be a healthy and safe journey through this weight loss and GLP-1 use. So I've heard different opinions, and I'd love to hear everybody, Morgan, your opinion on this too, that GLP-1s are used for off-label indications like for NAFLD and NASH and depression and more. And just to, when I started looking into things right before we jumped on, I saw some studies. One was looking at Liraglutide has positive effects on bone formation and the prevention of bone loss, which I'd love to learn more about on future episodes that we do for GLP-1s. And then another study was looking at liraglutide in type 2 diabetes, preventing changes in bone resorption and preventing hip and bone mineral density issues. And then I've heard of a double-blind placebo-controlled study showing that GLP-1s can decrease aldosterone secretion in healthy individuals, and then suggest that GLP-1 can act on blood pressure and the RAS system, or renin-angiotensin aldosterone system. It's late. Please forgive me. And then I've also seen where GLP-1s are being associated with notable reductions in depression rate scales when compared with controlled treatments, according to recent results from the American Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry. And then one thing that I saw was, I've heard of conflicting evidence where the GLP-1s are reducing the patient's appetite and result in a depletion of the proper ingestion of essential nutrients, leading to negative effects on preserving bone density. All areas for us to dive deeper into, but just some food for thought for what our audience thinks about this, or what you think about this, or what you've heard. It's just a good discussion point for this class in general.
Yeah, I think that's a big point that is being talked about, you know, on social media, online, within the medical community themselves, is, you know, we still have some stuff to learn about these agents. And I think to your point, there's maybe even conflicting evidence. You know, to your point, you saw a study about maybe it in decreasing depression, but maybe a couple months ago, I remember I saw potential warnings of increase in suicidality. So it's a little bit contradictory, and maybe some of the evidence that we're finding. And so I don't think we know quite everything yet. But, and again, to your point about, you know, really listening to patients and what they are telling you, I think is the biggest thing. And so to your point too about proper nutrition, especially considering the mechanism of weight loss and slowing gastric emptying and all that stuff, is, you know, if you have a patient who's losing weight and their blood sugars are under control, that's great. But if they're not eating, like, that is a problem. I've had a patient come to me and say, yeah, you know, sometimes I might be at the grocery store and I feel a little like faint, like I might pass out. And I'm like, well, have you eaten? And they said, no. And I was like, well, that's a problem. You know, I don't want to have you having lower blood sugars or lower weight while sacrificing, you know, you being healthy as an individual. That's not an appropriate trade-off. And so I think having those frank conversations, and again, I think this also points to what we'll talk about in future episodes about the role of social media and just the internet in these conversations about, you know, maybe weight loss being the major component that we're looking at, but at what cost, at what are we sacrificing? And so I'll be very interested in the rest of the series to see the kind of conversations we have revolving around that.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but it was when Mounjaro started to hit the market is when I just felt like there was a lot of issue with accessibility of GLP-1 receptor agonists. And then that's like the same time that it started to hit the market as far as social media and big, big influencers like the Kardashians, yeah, and Elon Musk talking about using Ozempic. And it's just, it's hard because it's already an issue with access for patients who need it for type 2 diabetes. And then when we get into the whole world of using it off-label for things, that becomes a whole nother problem for, yeah, everyone's accessibility to it, right?
Yeah. And I think that goes into this conversation we're having about side effects and to, you know, these other indications possibly that could futurely come from GLP-1s is, you know, think about way before we had the indications for GLP-1s for weight loss, people were using Ozempic off label. They were using a diabetic medication for weight loss because they saw the benefits. And now that we have an indication and we know that it's safe, it has that appropriate indication and that appropriate designation for, let's say, Wegovy for the Ozempic counterpart. But the issue was, at the time, was one, it was causing supply chain issues, but two, we didn't have the data to back it up to say, like, okay, this is safe. And, you know, I talked about the mechanism earlier about how now we know that it's safe because of that glucose dependent mechanism for people who don't have diabetes. We didn't know that yet. So people were just using it off label, not knowing about the potential consequences. And so we see all these potential future indications, but we have to have data to make sure it's safe. We use things off label all the time in medicine, but we have to at least have the literature to back it up to say, hey, this is going to be safe and it's not going to be harmful to you.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I'm excited to dive deeper into it and hear the audience's perspective on it. Like, what does the audience think, and what do others have related to this topic that we can dive into? I'm excited for where it can go. All right. So now it's important to talk about who shouldn't be getting these medications. Morgan, can you cover key contraindications with GLP-1s?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So there's two really important hardcore contraindications in the package insert, the whole shebang, right? So those two are going to be medullary thyroid cancer. I get a lot of questions in clinical practice. Well, what about Hashimoto's? What about papillary thyroid cancer? Those are okay. It's very specifically medullary thyroid cancer. The other big X contraindication is the multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome type 2. This one was specifically observed in like rodent studies. So never actually in humans have we seen this evidence that it could be harmful. But because of that, it still just has this kind of big X contraindication for those patients. And going back to the thyroid cancer, it's for patients who have it and then also their family members. If their family history includes this history of medullary thyroid cancer, we also want to be aware and avoid using those patients. Other things are more in the kind of caution or avoid category, not necessarily a true contraindication, but a lot of it is maybe post-market studies and surveillance that have kind of brought some of these things out. So pancreatitis is a big one in the conversation. And so really this is kind of marked as an increased risk. I think a thing to highlight though, and that I've really gathered from clinical practice is that people with diabetes are already at high risk for things like pancreatitis anyways. A lot of times they have high triglycerides as well, which also puts them at risk for pancreatitis. So again, looking at like the true causation of these agents to be the sole reason that somebody's having pancreatitis, I don't know if we have enough evidence to say that. There have been studies kind of trying to investigate this a little bit further, because again, there is this bias and looped in this that people with diabetes are already at high risk for these conditions anyway. So can you say that GLP-1s were truly the cause? So to kind of be evaluated. Gastroparesis and then irritable bowel disease as well. Again, thinking about like the mechanism of how these work, you're slowing gastric emptying. And so if somebody has gastroparesis, they're already struggling with mobility issues within their intestinal system, may not be the best therapeutic choice for them. And then also looking at pregnancy, again, pregnancy is a weird place. And, you know, I've said it on previous podcasts. I've worked in the OBGYN space. It's just not having enough data. Same with pediatrics in that area of, you know, who's going to sign up their pregnant wife or their child for a clinical trial to, you know, be tested for these things and used for research. It's not as common that people are going to sign up for these things. So the data is always going to kind of be lacking in these areas. So right now, we just don't have enough evidence to say that it's going to be safe in, you know, a pregnant population. And then the other population that comes up a lot is type 1 diabetics. And so, you know, a lot of these agents have the notion on them not indicated for use in type 1 diabetics, but there's been a lot of conversation about type 1 diabetics being able to use it for the weight loss indication. Again, going back to that mechanism, the glucose dependent mechanism, that if there's not this excess sugar, that it's not going to maybe affect their blood sugar. But that still needs a lot more research to be able to be like a commonly accepted practice to have a type 1 diabetic on a GLP-1. But I've talked a lot to my endocrinology friends and they have seen patients be on it and do well. But I still think that's an area that needs a lot more research before it's going to be widely accepted for that kind of use.
Yeah, I totally agree. Couldn't said it better myself. All right. Lastly, let's tackle a big hurdle, which is cost. So how do these drugs fare in terms of cost effectiveness and patient access? And are there patient assistance programs or other things out there to help improve patient access?
They're expensive. Let's just start there. They are so overly expensive. So really talking about the more popularly utilized one. So I would say, at least in my clinical practice, you're talking about Victoza, Trulicity, Ozempic, Mounjaro, if we're talking about like just diabetes meds right now. And then pretty much their counterparts for the weight loss indications are going to be relatively around the same price. So any of those options, you're looking anywhere from like $1,300 to $1,700 a month for these meds, if you're talking cash price, right? And so my issue becomes, even if you have an insurance company that covers these medications, sometimes their copay is still just absolutely ridiculous. And so I see a lot of times, I personally, in my clinical practice, work with a lot of patients who have social barriers, financial insecurity, food insecurity even. And so, you know, let's say, for example, they have Medicare and they get prescribed a GLP-1, it's approved, but they still have a $42 copay. Well, a $42 copay to URI might not be that significant. We might be like, oh, wow, that's a great deal. But for one of my patients, they can't do $42 every single month for one med when they have a multitude of other meds that might also have $42 copays or $30 copays. And it starts to add up for a lot of these people, especially people on Medicare who, you know, are in their retirement, not maybe having as stable as an income. And so that's something to definitely consider for these people. And so even magically, if it gets approved by your insurance company, it still might not be affordable to some patients. And so let's jump to the other side of patients, let's say commercial insurance. So all of these GLP-1s are still brand names. So a lot of them still have copay cards. So unfortunately, our copay cards cannot be used for our Medicare or Medicaid patients because they're federally funded insurance programs. So really only our commercial patients can use them because a lot of times these copay cards too, you can't use them if you have no insurance at all. Now, the caveat with the copay cards is they might say, oh, get it as low as $0 or $10 a month. But a lot of times on the back of the card, there's going to be this little caveat that says max coverage of $500 a month or something like that. So let's say your patient gets the GLP-1 covered and they get it down to a copay of $800 a month, but the card has a max benefit per month of $500 a month. Well, then your patient is still left with a copay responsibility of $300 a month, which for me, that's not accessible. I'm not paying $300 a month for one medication. So it's, even though these copay cards are out there, they might not cover all of it. Even they say if they can get it down to as low as $0 or $10, might not always actually work depending upon how much of your patient's insurance is actually covering what portion of the cost of that medicine. Now, on the other side, for our more low-income patients, a lot of these manufacturers, because the products are still brand name, will offer something called a patient assistance program. So these are programs offered by the manufacturer where if a patient meets a certain income limit, which for a lot of these programs are anywhere between $300 to $400 of the federal poverty level. And you can look up those rates and what that actually quantifies to as far as like exact numbers of like a yearly salary. That also is dependent upon number of people in the household and things like that. But usually it's anywhere from 300 to 400% of the federal poverty level. And then those people who are below that would get approved for these patient assistance programs where the manufacturer will essentially just give them the medication for free. Some of them will ship it directly to the patient's house. Post-COVID, a lot of them are requiring it be sent to the physician's office. Then the patient has to come get it from the physician's office, which if you look at my patient population, a lot of those people have transportation issues. So that's just another time for them having to come to find transportation, or they have to wait until their next clinic visit to come get the medication, which again, just causes more of an access issue overall. So when we look at patient assistance programs for our specific GLP-1s, it gets a little frustrating. So I will say flat out, any of these brands that have a counterpart that's indicated for obesity treatment or for weight loss, they are not offered through a patient assistance program through the manufacturer. So the only thing that these manufacturers offer is the diabetes indicated medication. So we can start with Victoza and Ozempic. So those are made by Novo Nordisk. And so Novo Nordisk has a patient assistance program. And so you are able to go through that patient assistance program if your patient meets income requirements to get them this medication for free. They do require it be shipped to the office. So again, that transportation issue may come into play for some patients. I will say they have gotten really, really overloaded with applications and requests for these medications. And so it is very difficult to get somebody physically on the phone. If you're looking for a status update, did they even get the application? There has been so many patients where I have to send the application in like three separate times before they actually say they received it. So that has been a constant struggle. So I always have to kind of preemptively warn my provider who's in it or my patient who's trying to get enrolled, like, hey, it could be months maybe before we hear back with an approval, denial, hear anything. And then maybe even another month before the med physically actually gets here. So kind of setting that clear expectation in advance. So although it's supposed to increase accessibility, it is a really difficult process to actually get there. Now, Trulicity and Mounjaro are made by Eli Lilly. Trulicity used to have a patient assistance program, but about a year ago, they stopped accepting applications because of the increase in demand. So you can no longer get a patient on a patient assistance program for Trulicity. And there actually doesn't even exist one for Mounjaro because, again, the increased demand. So for those two medications, anybody who was enrolled in the Trulicity patient assistance program can still continue to be enrolled in that program. But if you're a new patient trying to get on Trulicity, it's just, they're not accepting applications. So it's not going to happen. So again, these programs were designed to increase accessibility, but it is getting more and more difficult to actually get patients to be enrolled, even if they meet all the qualifications, to actually get them access to these meds if they can't afford it through their insurance.
Yeah, I remember on my fourth year rotations, that was one of the big things that I was introduced to during that time, was calling about patient assistance application status updates, sending them in and doing all the things, jumping through the hoops. And it was like, I was on the phone. We went through that period at the same time. So I was doing a lot of things virtually with rotations. Mm-hmm. So that was part of it, where I was on the phone for like an hour and a half doing other things for my rotation. And then like finally they'd answer, and I'd have a 2-minute conversation. I was like, this is crazy.
Or I'd wait on the phone for an hour and a half for you to just tell me, oh, we never got it. What do you mean? You never got it. I unfortunately have to have that conversation with people. I have providers that they're like, oh, this is one that has the patient assistance program. I'm like, yes, but let's be clear. It can take a long, long time for this to actually come to fruition and be a real thing that my patient can physically hold in their hands. And then it creates complications if I want a dose change, like specifically the Ozempic. We talked about how it requires a whole new pen for, you know, if you're going to change a different dose. Well, if I do that, it's going to take 3 months before I can get a dose change. Like, how is that going to happen for my patient? It's not. That's the answer. It's not going to happen. And, you know, I think it's getting increasingly harder with just natural backorder issues, too. And so, you know, for example, Victoza, Novo Nordisk announced at the beginning of this year, as of January 1, they were pulling back Victoza production to focus on Ozempic Wegovy because of the increased demand. So you're having patients either, if they're still on Victoza, not being able to find it at the retail pharmacies, or we had people on the Victoza patient assistance program that their shipments are severely delayed. We had a lady literally this week who got approved for the Victoza program, I want to say beginning of February. And they're like, oh, we'll ship it when it's available. It's the beginning of March now. So, you know, and when it's going to come in, we don't know, but she's approved. So it's just a constant struggle with all of that stuff.
Yeah. And then something that I saw between even residencies, like at Duke, a lot of the pharmacists practicing in different areas, especially in specialty clinics like endocrinology or, I don't know, GI, neurology, infectious disease, they would have technicians in the clinical practice that would just, their sole job was patient access and anything that could just help move on clinical production for getting these patients the medications they needed, or affordability, and in a lot of different scenarios. And that really helps the pharmacists, I think, so that they're not sitting there on the phone for an hour and a half, you know, when they could have been making a lot of more high yield clinical activities, right? They could have been doing more high yield clinical activities rather than focusing on that. So advocating for help in those situations is really vital, I think, for the pharmacy team, because it was a head and shoulders difference when there was help for the pharmacist to do these things and if they were doing it by themselves.
Oh yeah, for sure. We have a running joke in my clinic that some of our nurses have become secretaries at a certain point in the day, just handling all the paperwork and the phone calls and this, that, and the other. And it's just, yeah, it definitely can become overbearing, and you don't get to get to all the, you know, clerical work because you're doing your clinical responsibilities. And then by the time you're done with your clinical responsibilities, it's 5, 6, 7 o'clock. And what time do you have to, you know, deal with the paperwork stuff? So yeah. Maybe we'll find a solution one day.
And it seems like GLP-1s might be as expensive as Betty the Bronco.
Oh, yeah. You know what? That's funny. I'm not going to divulge, you know, how expensive Betty the Bronco is. But I will say GLP-1's cash price do cost more than my car payment. We'll just put it is more than Betty the Bronco. You're actually correct. It is more than Betty the Bronco.
That is crazy. People are just trying to get their A1C down, and it's just costing.
They got to pay more than the cost of Betty the Bronco. I know. What a world we live in.
All right. We've covered a lot today as far as GLP-1 agonists are concerned, but we've just opened the door on all the possible topics that we can dive into. We're excited to continue forward with this series.
Yeah. And so I hope you all continue to watch the series. You've got just a little bit of a sneak peek into some of the topics we're going to further dive into, like the role of the internet and social media with GLP-1s, you know, what Are we dealing with pros, cons of GLP-1s becoming as popular as they've become? And so stay tuned for the rest of the series, really diving into more of that clinical real life stuff that we have planned for you. But for now, thank you so much for tuning into another episode of the Farm So Hard podcast, the ambulatory care version. And we'll see you next time. So I farm so hard, employees wanna find me, and then wanna hire me. What's 100K to a guy like me? Could you please remind me? Farm so hard, this ain't easy. Working late nights, you best believe me. My grades can only go ace. Never wanna see another B unless I'm Jay-Z. Farm so hard, let's get paid. Let's get paid.